The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do? The podcast where I, your host, Dead Air Dennis Maller, interviews artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And the artist and entertainer we are talking to you today is full-time professional musician and violinist, Asher Laub. Asher and I recorded this a while back. Now, here is a good podcast to listen to because there's some nuances here. All right. Asher and I have never met. We recorded this remotely. His home in New York. Here in my podcast studio in Boston. He reached out to me. He heard about my podcast. He was like, hey, I would think I would be a good guest on your podcast. Would you like to interview me? And I looked him up and I was like, yeah, why not? Professional musician. He had a medical degree, a nursing degree. He almost became a nurse. He comes from a family of scientists and doctors. And he has a very interesting story to tell. Here's where the nuance come in. I don't think he expected the podcast to be the style of podcast that we have. I think he's a guy, he's done TV shows. He's done like morning news TV shows, like network TV. Like he's done real press. All right. Not me. Like I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about like real, like people, like millions of viewers, you know? And I think he thought this was going to be just another like softball-y little speaking sound clip, buzzword kind of interview. And it wasn't. Like, I don't think he expected the long form deep dive conversation. And I felt like he was a little guarded, which is understandable. You know, I had to open up to get him to open up about stuff. And I think he did. I think towards the end, he opened up about a lot of things that he would not have expected to talk about. Great sense of humor. The guy laughed. He made good jokes. I enjoyed talking to him. I wish we had more time to talk. Unfortunately, we only had a short period to record with. And I wish that he and I knew each other better. So he would have opened up a little more. I think there's some more gems that he has hidden away that he could have talked about during our interview. But he did open up. He got deep about some of the things. And you're going to hear them. I don't think he expected to talk about some of his health issues. He has made mention to him, but I don't think he expected to talk as in-depth as he did about it. So that was fun. That was interesting. He is a very talented musician. You should check out his music, asherlaub.com. He's a very tremendous violinist. By the way, listen to his violin. It's probably going to sound better than my voice. If you're just tuning in, I just recently left my job. That I talk about in this. This is actually, we recorded this back in January of 2023. In that, I talked about having my old job of doing AV tech at a hotel where there was soda, free soda aplenty. And now I'm doing Boston Duck Tours, where I give tours of Boston, 90-minute tours of Boston, 4 to 5 times a day. And you guys. Yeah, I mean, my voice sounds probably better than the last episode, but still not there. Today's my day off. I was trying to rest it, and then I realized I got this introduction to do. I have to talk to all you wonderful people. So there will be, don't worry, my voice in the interview sounds 10 times better than it sounds now. And hopefully, it'll sound 10 times better tomorrow. But cough drops have been my best friend. Chloraseptic has been my best friend. This wonderful honey and lemon and zinc spray has been my best friend. Water. I drank way too much tea today. Way too much. I have like one, maybe two iced teas in the morning and then water all the rest of the day. I've been doing a great job giving up the soda. I've had like one, maybe two sodas this week. Right. I talk about it in the thing. That's why I'm bringing it up. I'm preparing you. They're like, oh, I want to give up soda. Hey, I'm doing it. I'm trying. Well, I did have McDonald's this week and I ordered a Coke and I drank almost all the Coke. Almost all. There was some control of dumping it out. So we'll see if I can continue getting rid of that high fructose corn syrup out of my diet. And I hope you enjoy putting this podcast in your diet as you enjoy my conversation with violinist and nursing student Asher Laub. Are those Bose earbuds? Because I will say Bose makes beautiful, the most perfectly fitting earbuds I have ever had. They sound great. They feel comfortable, but they're so goddamn expensive. I cannot legitimately talk anybody into purchasing them. in good conscience, at least.
No, I don't think these are like the $1,000 bows. These are my more expensive ones. I use in the studio and like for live performances.
Are those the custom molded ones?
I don't feel the need for custom, even though all my musician friends tell me you'll never turn back. Cause I don't know, it does the job. Like it seals the ear. These frankly seal the ear. I don't know, like it doesn't have to be silent. Like I want a little bit of bleeding. I want to hear what's going on in reality out there.
Not me. When I put my earbuds in and I'm sitting on the subway train, I don't want to hear anything, because also it's mostly crazy people shouting and screaming at each other when I'm listening to my earbuds. So that's why I want silence. But like, yeah, when I worked, I worked cell phone sales at Best Buy a bunch of years back, and we sold a pair of Bose for a couple hundred bucks, like 250, 230, something like that. And I was like, I can't talk someone into buying these. They'll never know the difference in quality between these and a pair of $10 skull candies, but they feel so good and sound so wonderful.
I don't know. Eventually, when I do big concerts, I sometimes regret not having like the custom ears. Well,
you're using them for in-ear monitors, so you want to hear your music, the other musicians backing track, so that makes sense for in-ear monitoring.
Yeah, are you in New York City?
No, I live in Boston. So welcome to my podcast studio here in insufferable Boston, Massachusetts.
Oh, well, I when I was in Boston, well, thank you. The subway systems seemed way cleaner than New York. When you said crappiness,
there is a difference between New York and Boston subways. I say subway, like they call it the T here, the MBTA, yeah. And they focus on the letter T for some reason. But I just say generally for people who are not from the area, I just call it the subway.
Yeah.
But, you know, mass transit's going to attract crazy people no matter what city it is in.
Unfortunately, I'm sure San Francisco is pretty horrendous. I have a brother-in-law out there. But yeah, New York City, I haven't taken the subway in a while, and it's just horrendous when I hear it on the news.
By the way, I know we're both on East Coast time or Eastern time. So I'm in New England. Where are you?
I'm in New York, Long Island.
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
I figured it, but the way you asked, oh, are you in New York? It didn't sound like you're like, oh, are you in the same city as me? It sounded like you're like, wait, are you in New York? Because I'm in Philadelphia. I wasn't sure. But because you are, if you live in New York City, but you're from the state of New York in general, right? But not the city, right?
Yeah, but like upstate Buffalo near Canada. That's where I grew up.
Okay.
Although I've been in New York City for 20 years.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. I just moved to Boston. Next month, in like 3 weeks, will be my 10-year anniversary, so I'm officially a Baltimore expat now in 3 weeks.
Oh, very cool.
I grew up in Baltimore.
Uh-huh.
I worked in D.C., went to school and worked in D.C., and then I moved to Boston. So I've only lived in these three cities, but I've also never been somewhere so gentrified and segregated as Boston is. And like, you don't realize when you grow up in Baltimore and you grow up in DC, you don't realize that you're so inundated with people of color until you're in a place that's devoid of people of color.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. But Boston's definitely, definitely gentrified. And so is San Fran. And, my Aunt Sheila, who's in the Boston Symphony, is actually, lives up in Boston. Her along with my uncle Warren, who's a teaches at Harvard. Speaking of snobby people, no, I love you. I love you all. Dearly, aunt and uncle. No, I just yeah, that's my connection to Boston. They are wonderful people, by the way. They are wonderful people.
So that brings me into the question I was going to ask you: is that as a violinist, do you come from a family of musicians? Which apparently you kind of do.
Yeah, I just threw the spoiler in there. Yes, very much so.
Okay, so your aunt she plays classical music in a symphony, is that your paternal or maternal aunt?
So my uncle Warren is my maternal uncle. They got married. But the musical side of stuff, yeah, is pretty deeply entrenched in my family. So my mother plays ukulele, father plays violin, like fiddle. Three of my siblings all play instruments from a very young age. So yeah, flute, oboe, and violin. And then I play violin. I'm the middle youngest. Second from the youngest.
Okay, so we have flute, violinist, ukulele, all these
three violins,
small instruments. Nobody in your family basically plays an instrument that will throw their back out.
Well, actually, the violin is the perfect instrument to do that.
Really? I mean, what's a violin weigh? 4 pounds?
Yeah. Well, but and it's, you're right. It's light. Although electric violins are a little heavier, which is why I wrap it. I have the strap around my neck, around my waist. But it's not the weight itself that destroys your back and creates curvature in your spine. It's the intensity, the speed in which you're playing notes, that cause like undue stress to your arms, your ligaments, and your spine.
No tuba players in the family.
Well, that I would never be able to handle past a few months.
Like, there's nobody just like burning around bulky instruments and stuff. Everyone just has these tiny little, oh, we're going to put all their tiny, you know, minuscule. I don't want to say that they're inferior, but they all have wee little instruments.
Yeah.
Wee little violins, our yeah. wee little flute players.
Well, we're wee little people. You know, I'm like 5'7". Pretty lanky. I'm like 130 pounds, you know.
You're not built for carrying around a drum set.
No, although I play it pretty well.
Somebody else will carry around, set it up for you, just sit down.
Yeah.
So you come from a family of musicians. Are they also professional musicians, or are they hobbyist musicians that kind of passed the trade on to you?
So neither of my parents were professional. My aunt's professional. My three siblings.
This is an aunt by marriage, so genetically we're not getting anything from her. It's just your family is drawn to other talented musicians.
Yeah, I guess so. That's a good point. But my three other siblings could have easily made it professionally. They were all like pretty much like they won NISMA competitions, pretty much all of them. They were like first orchestra, like my brother was first oboist in the Boston Symphony. That was my UPenn Orchestra, which is a pretty big deal. So, but you know, he went off into business. My oldest brother went to engineering, you know, et cetera. And I'm the only one who shifted from my 3 degrees in the sciences back to music, which was actually pretty much easier for me.
Has any of them secretly admitted to you yet, like Thanksgiving dinner, like, kind of jealous that you made it as a musician? Is there any of that animosity?
We're more of the passive aggressive type. So if it were there, it would be a little difficult to discern. It's like what isn't said as opposed to what is said.
You go out and play your music and I'll go build buildings, you know, for people to live in.
Yeah. We're a different kind of family.
Well, I will say this. I've always been in, I'm a middle child, which means
fun.
I was born with I was born with the tragic disease of, as Kevin Pollak puts it, hey, look at me disorder. But I've always been competing with my one older brother. You know, I always envied him.
How much older?
Smart. He was intelligent. He's like 17 months older than me, so we almost grew up like together.
Okay,
like,
that's tough.
Like, my mother dressed us alike because she wanted people to think we were twins.
That's cute, but sibling rivalry, especially when there's such a small age gap, is like it poses a challenge.
Well, it's like he, you know, in high school did sports, and I was he was academic, and I was always athletic. So when he started doing sports in high school, he was like, well, I got to play football too. And I got to wrestle and play lacrosse.
Yeah.
And then he graduated, went to college and had a college radio show. And then I graduated from high school. Was like, oh, I think I'm going to be a radio disc jockey. So it's
that's funny.
Everything we tried to do, I had to keep at least competing. And luckily, I think I'm like, he went to film school. He went to college to be a filmmaker. I've actually been on real movies and TV show sets working as an actor,
right,
working, you know, as an audio op or as a, you know, doing the, you know, sound design and stuff like that. So everything he did that he didn't make it at, I went and made sure I made a professional career of it.
That's really funny. I mean, you guys obviously wanted to compete, but, you know, our kids,
I don't know if he wanted to. I think it's all the jealousy in my own head.
You know what's hilarious here is I'm a parent. I have an 11-year-old and a 3-year-old, and there's actual sibling rivalry there with an 8-year gap, which boggles my mind. And like, I look my 11-year-old in the face. I'm like, what is she's as high as your knee. You're competing to play the piano. Like, what are you gonna do?
Well, I gotta understand the 3-year-old wanting to be like, I want to be like my older sibling, and then, but the 11-year-old's like, Dad, he's playing my piano part.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, but they love each other. That's the good thing. Love hate sibling rivalry.
That's good. Well, all right. So let's start. So obviously, music was part of the family life when you were growing up. When and why did you or they decide for you the violin?
Well, there's a difference of opinion as to what actually happened. It's convenient that there's...
Oh, I love this revisionist history.
Yes. I happen to think I was right, even though I was 2.5 at the time. I thought I remembered not being overly excited, enthused over the violin. But I might have, you know, I do have some good memories of, like, you know, playing Mississippi Hot Dog. I mean, that was like a rock song at the time for me as a baby, you know, kid in diapers. But like, my mother claims that like I looked up to my brother who's like 6 years old, playing the violin, playing concertos. And I was like, I want to do that. So, you know, I'm pretty sure the way the chronology works is like violin sucked for me until the 11th grade. And then I started improvising, play with the jazz band. I'm like, I could do this. Like, I get used to this. Who wants to play concertos when they're a kid? I don't know. It's very overwhelming, very stressful.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you're... I'm 41. You're...
40.
40, yeah. So we're the same age, which means when you're a kid growing up in high school, Yellow Card wasn't around yet, so there wasn't that one cool band. There wasn't that one cool pop punk band that had a violinist for you to look up to.
Yeah, I mean, Dave Matthews was like kind of what I was waiting for. And then it was okay, like the thing. And then the guy became a rapist or something, or he was in the news, Boyd Tinsley. Yeah, I don't know if he was thrown in jail or something. So that kind of killed that.
Oh, I haven't heard those allegations against the Dave Matthews band. I just heard the allegations of how they're annoying and weird. That's why I think people
really
stop liking them.
Annoying.
I think people stop liking because they're like, this is just dumb.
Oh, really? Well, I don't know.
I think they're talented people, but you know, it's that thing. It's like they become too popular, and you want to now hate them.
Well, I hope they do that to half of the top 40s artists that are raking in the billions of streams on Spotify. I'm not going to mention specific names, but there's a lot of...
What is that? What's that one song from his Show Your World? Hug Your Skirt a Little More and Show Your World to Me? Is that Satellite or...
I'm not sure.
Crash Into Me.
Oh,
Crash Into Me. Yeah, hike up your skirt and show me your... hike up your skirt and show me your world. Yeah, that's a little creepy.
Look, the guy created a genre. You got to respect that. But
yeah, he created a genre that also gave us OAR, so...
OAR. Well, what do you think of somebody like Drake?
I think he's an arrogantly talented musician. I think he puts out good songs, but I think he has an overrated self-opinion. But his stuff is good. But he also surrounds himself with talented producers and beat makers, too. So, you know, that comes from a good business side. Mike, what's your opinion on Drake? I mean, being from Buffalo, you're close to Canada. He's a Canadian.
Oh, I forgot that part. Yeah. Well, him and Kanye, I kind of put them in the same category, to be honest, in terms of like their, you know, they use the producers and mm-hmm. I mean, so does DJ Khaled. I mean, there's some actually funny video memes of him like actually trying to DJ and apparently he cannot, but I don't know. I should stop trash talking these major artists and may end up working with them in short order.
I love that positive thinking. It's like, oh, I should stop trash talking people I might work with someday. Meanwhile, me as a comedian is like, I'll trash talk anyone because I want them to at least pay attention to me, even if it's seething hatred.
Well, and I'm saying that I should be careful because it actually did happen to me a number of years ago. I posted something online like, look out, you know, you're not always going to be at the top. And then I ended up doing like a bunch of concerts with him. So, yeah, I don't know.
Did he see that? Did he know the tweets even existed?
I'm hoping he didn't. I think he's probably got too much going on to care. But I guess it drew some attention from other fans. I don't know. Maybe that's.
Hey, wait a minute. So you know what? Cancel culture even comes to musicians at times.
Yeah, it's a good point. But you got to be really trashy to be canceled in the music industry.
Yeah, I also don't really believe in cancel culture. It's people being held responsible for their illegal transaction, their illegal transgressions, or people who succeed despite the controversy, i.e. Shane Gillis, or what's that country musician that was dropping N-bombs and was banned from SNL?
Cardi B?
No, country music.
White oh, country boy. Music. Sorry, I missed that part. Not sure, but there's a whole lot of them.
Waller? Anyway, doesn't matter. Mm-mm. Somebody knows who I'm talking about. If you know who I'm talking about out there,
give us a shout out.
Anyway, let's get back to you. So when you were growing up playing violin, you had early success with violin, playing with the Boston. See, now I'm doing it too. The Buffalo Philharmonic. When you're a kid that age, playing with something that as adults, we understand how big of an opportunity that is. As a kid, did you understand how big of an opportunity that was? Or it's just like, hey, whatever, I'm playing violin with a bunch of other people.
Well, Klein Hans Hall, I mean, yeah, it's pretty overwhelming. It's a beautiful hall. That's where it was, as I remember. But I had been playing, I was pretty much born on stage. So I've been playing with the Buffalo, with the Greater Buffalo Youth String Orchestra, Greater Buffalo Youth Orchestra, which pretty much is the older version of that, where kids from all over the state are coming up to that area to play at SUNY Buffalo. So you kind of get used to the stage, used to the, you know, the auditoriums, and used to the concerts because you're playing it every month. It was a little overwhelming, like playing alongside adult pros as opposed to like kid prodigies, you know, even though honestly, I don't think there was much of a gap in terms of skills. I know it sounds shocking to you, but like the virtuosic abilities of the 10th, 11th, and 12th graders that I played with in upstate, and I'm sure in other areas, like if you're in New York, I'm sure they have the equivalent, but they all went to Juilliard, like a bunch of them, like 7 or 8 or 9 of them, like each one of those years, like it was like a shoe into Juilliard, and they ended up, you know, becoming professional musicians and then teaching and stuff like that. But skill-wise, I don't think there was much of a gap, like I said, like with the pros. From my vantage point, I mean, we're all playing Paganini at that age, you know. Maybe the adults were playing a little bit better, but
see, that's one of the things that I find interesting, because I am also a performer since a young age. Like, I started in community theater, and even before I was doing that, I was, you know, playing, you know, putting on plays for my parents and my brother and sister. We were always fantasy playing. And I was always performing in front of people in groups and stuff like that. So somebody like you, who grew up just naturally being on stage all the time, and me, someone who's naturally being on stage all the time, I don't feel most of the time what one defines as stage fright, because I've been on stage for so long. What is there? It's just a natural thing. Like I do stand up comedy because of what I do on stage is what I was doing at parties, just gathering people around and talking and telling stories and making jokes and quips and being back and forthy. So it was such a natural transition for me to go in that. Similar, I assume, for you, someone who, like, at your age, who's been performing your whole life, are you even able to understand some of your milestones? Because for me, I have friends who never performed until they started doing comedy, and then they get to perform at a certain club, and they're ecstatic about it. They're like, oh my God, I've been wanting to play this club my whole life. Meanwhile, me, I was like, oh no, I'm a professional. I've been doing this. Of course I should be performing at this club. So I don't get to enjoy those kinds of things because this is supposed to seem so natural to me. Do you ever have feelings like that where you're like, I can't sit and enjoy the moment because I'm just so naturally used to being in this scenario?
Yes and no. I could totally relate. It's cool talking to another performer like yourself. You know, Madison Square Garden, Carnegie Hall, Lincoln Center. I mentioned this in a number of interviews. These are all like iconic venues, PBS, you know, Master Theater. These are all venues that I've played. And it's cool. It's like, you know, it's exciting and it's good for your career and it's cool to share. But it's also sort of like when you're a pro, this is what people expect from me now. And now it's like more pressure to continue doing those types of venues, which is really hard to sustain when you don't have like a major label backing you or major money. You can't just sort of like, it's not like basking in the glory. It's like, hey, this is cool. And now I got to keep working after this. That's kind of how I feel.
Yeah. No, there's an inherent anxiety sometimes with being able to sustain the level of performance or the level of success, for lack of a better word, that you're at, that you're achieving at this level. So do you, you know, let we gets heavy. I don't mind. You know, I'm a huge proponent for talking about mental health.
Sure. I'm an open book,
but I think it's an open thing. I love to talk to the people that don't have that, that either do have the same level of anxiety about certain things or pressure more like, but also I love talking to people who don't feel that necessary need, because I don't know what that's like. I only know what it's like to live with pressure and anxiety and worry all the time. Do you feel the how do you deal with some of the pressures of, hey, I just did this really big thing, I need to follow up with an equal or bigger yet thing?
I'm generally pretty even keeled.
That's great.
Which I strive to achieve that state of mind and actually produce music around that state of mind, because I literally grew up on stage in this performance sort of mentality. Because I got a family to deal with, to protect and to support, that I'm responsible.
That's how the kids want to be referred to, as dealt with.
Yeah, honey, if you're watching this, I did not mean it that way. I got to be careful the way I speak. I sleep on the couch.
Honey, if you're listening to this through the walls, I didn't mean it.
Yeah, I don't think she watches my interviews anyway, necessarily. But back to what I was saying, so staying kind of even keeled is really important to me, because I take that approach because I look at all these other people who have risen and fallen, and they've really risen like beyond what I've ever achieved, and then they've really crashed, and I've seen so many of these people do it, and it's like, oh, they get signed to a major label, like that's the ultimate. No, that's just when the journey starts, and then they drive you into the ground. You look at guys like Avicii, he drank himself to death pretty much. You have endless stories, Michael Jackson, and these poor people, like, would you ever want to be like them? Like, what do they get? Like, they don't have a quality family life. There's nothing close, let me tell you. For having, speaking to you from the vantage point of somebody who's been on stage, who's played with a number of celebrities, who's been on to national television, there's nothing that comes close to family, like a non-dysfunctional family. I mean, like the next generation, in my opinion. That being said, like it's nice to have both, and I try to achieve both with a stable mindset. So. Which is an incredible challenge. But when you have people driving you and owning you, like a company, it's hard for you to say no to your family and, you know, for a performance or for a world tour or for whatever. So I've been struggling trying to achieve that careful balance. And I'm trying to grow gradually without losing everything. It's not easy.
No, it's nice to hear that you have a family aspect in mind for your life and your career, and that you want to make time to be with your family. I'm a single man. I don't have interest in being a family. Like, I love my family. I'll see them when I can. They know I have certain things that I have to do. Like, I don't go back to Baltimore for holidays. I refuse to pay overpriced holiday airfare just to be annoyed by my family.
If they're annoying, then yeah,
I agree. Off season when it's cheaper to be annoyed.
Yeah, I totally get it. Family can be annoying, can be difficult. I've missed all sorts of family events for gigs, but my immediate family is something that is core to me, and that's something I can't necessarily miss.
That's excellent to hear, because I have friends who are, you know, most of my friends are musicians, and now a lot of my friends are comedians. You know, growing up, most of my friends were musicians. We played in punk bands and went to punk shows and, you know, skanked around at ska shows with trumpet players and, you know, horns and drums and guitars and oh my. But the a lot of them obviously gave up their dream of being musicians when they had families. And I'm terrified of that. I'm terrified to have a kid and then want to resent my child for ruining my career.
Oh,
that's what I fear. That's my personal fear. I don't want to be that parent. I want to be a parent that loves their kid and wants everything best for them. I'm just afraid that I will not be that person when push comes to shove, that I'll, like, they exist. It's not, you know, how many bad parents are out there that abuse their kids mentally, physically, whatever, because they quote unquote ruined their lives, or because they couldn't live up to the expectations that they wanted to, or they live vicariously through their kids. I'm sure in the concert world of music, you've seen that tiger mom, to use a pejorative term,
yeah,
about parents who are pushing their kids to be this thing that they wanted to be, and they're living vicariously through their kid.
All the time, or a lot. I haven't seen it with everybody, but I've seen it with a lot of dysfunctional people, and that's somebody I don't want to be. And sometimes I slip into a little bit into that mentality, and I try to catch myself, and I think, okay, how much sleep did you get last night? How much sleep did you get this whole week? What kind of stress have you been under? Do you want to end up being 80 years old and your kid resenting you, my kid? And the answer is no. So I catch myself, but I have to constantly be self-aware, and it takes a lot of work because I wear a lot of hats. I do a lot of work. I do a ton of interviews and music production and collaborations, and I'm constantly working. I'm doing events, an event today, last night. I'm constantly working, and it's really easy to get short with your kids, and it's something I catch myself in. So I have a lot of respect for you, for your awareness that...
Oh, for being fearful? Thank you.
Yeah, no, but your self-awareness, because a lot of people don't make that decision, and they just take a shit all over the place, and they don't do well in their career, or they may do well in their career, and their kids hate them. That's not...
Well, also, I mean, I'm saying I don't want to have kids because of that fear. It's probably also I'm not having kids because I'm short, fat, bald, and I have glasses. I offer nothing to the gene pool. So there might also be that holding me back.
That could be what attracts a woman to you.
Well, that and, like, I'm allergy free, so their kids won't have hay fever. Ladies.
Hey, that's some pretty impressive genes there. Yeah.
So as a kid, you grew up, you went to college, you mentioned you went to school for science. What was the inspiration to going to school for whatever the science field that it was that you graduated in?
I mean, I was born in the sciences. My father's a PhD. My uncle's an MD. Like, there's just lots of, like, doctors and nerdy people running around my family. So higher education is, we all went to grad school. So, and it was something I was always interested in naturally, just because, you know, your dad's a paleontologist. So, okay, yeah, science is an important thing. So, I got an undergrad in bio, master's in science education, then nursing degree. So then threw it away.
And then when you graduated from college, did you go into that field or?
I did for a number of years. And but music, I was always a professional musician throughout, working my way through undergrad, graduate school, just paying the bills throughout. Even I was married and I was in school. There was just, like, I had to pay the bills. So music was like the no brainer for me. So it was an easy transition out of it. It was a stressful decision because I invested so much in my science degrees, but you know, it is what it is.
See, that's what's interesting with you is because that's the exact opposite of everyone else. Everyone else is brought up that I know, you know, most people are brought up to be like, hey, you need a legitimate job. You need a legitimate degree. If you want to go ahead and chase these fantasies of being a musician or artist or actor or whatever, you can go chase those, but make sure you have a stable job. You're the opposite. You literally used arts to pay for your schooling to survive, to get this very legitimate science degree, and still went into music.
Yeah, but also most people end up on the brink of death like I did. So, yeah. You know.
That you walked me into the point that I was talking about that I wanted to know about. You suffered an injury that almost made you ineligible to play again. What happened?
For many months, yeah, I wasn't able to. I was no longer able to play. Couldn't lift the instrument. Diagnosed with inflammatory condition, chronic, which is pretty debilitating, pretty serious, but I was still able to work and play and I was earning money. So I was kind of ignoring what my body was telling me. You're inflamed, your back hurts, you have chronic pain, that kind of stuff. And it actually advanced to the point of adrenal insufficiency where I was in a wheelchair for many months and permanent dosage of Cortef. Thought it was the end for me. I was literally a vegetable for a very long time. And
how old were we when this happened?
I think it was like in the young 30 range, about eight years ago. Yeah.
Okay.
Something my son, who was 3 at the time, remembers, which was pretty insane. Wouldn't wish it upon anybody. But I did get out of that mess, and I think I'm better because of it. You know, what you say, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So it was one of those things. And I think I was one of those rare cases where I was actually able to emerge victorious. But it also changed my life perspective because it made me realize how short life is and how petty our decisions are when we're sort of driven by what's around us. People in authoritative positions sort of telling us, dictating what we should be doing with our lives. And I just sort of like gave that all the finger and I said, you know, I'm going to take some risks and I'm going to try to find joy, like true joy. And I continue to take those risks with my career.
What kind of, and what risks are we talking about for the people who aren't familiar with your career that are listening?
Well, first of all, being in music is a risk. Being mm-hmm. self-employed is a risk. Mm-hmm. Pretty much building your income off of something that you're inventing from scratch. I mean, to a large part. I mean, you know, there are plenty of musicians out there. There's plenty of self-employed people out there, but the combination isn't the greatest. I'm not exactly in finance here. You know, I rely on fans and clients to for bookings. And the way I've grown is through data-driven decisions. And that's pretty much been my way of succeeding the way I have. And it's tough, but it's worked to a certain extent. Yeah, I'm here, and
that's
I'm
good. What was it that they did to help? So the condition you suffered from was inflammatory muscle disease.
A few conditions, chronic inflammatory okay. condition, disease, and adrenal insufficiency, which was the icing on the cake.
What's the adrenal deficiency? I went to 6 years of community college and didn't graduate. I don't know medical terms.
That's okay. I don't even think a lot of the doctors really fully understand it because all they understand is medicine and drugs, the pharmaceutical industry, which pretty much drives the industry. But there's my cynicism emerging. Uncle Ed, if you're watching, I love you dearly. I do respect what you do. Adrenal insufficiency, essentially, I didn't produce enough cortisol. I have very low cortisol levels, which... Hormones, you know, the adrenal glands are kind of, you can see them as the engines, as the batteries of the body. So if you don't have enough hormones, your hormones are imbalanced, or you don't have pretty much enough cortisol running through your bloodstream, you can't produce basic functions and you're on your way to, you know, where. So that's where I was at. Yeah.
Okay. And then how did they, the diagnosis, was it just... You started feeling run down, you went to the doctors, they did tests, did you collapse on stage? How is it that they found out?
I literally collapsed. I was feeling lightheaded for a period and I collapsed. And it happened a couple times. So I just didn't, my blood pressure plummeted. And it was sustained level. So couldn't figure it out. You know, it's like I was eating meals and stuff, but it was part of my chronic inflammation. And my GI tract was getting messed up. My colon, it was a big mess. It's a really long story. I don't want to bore your audience with, and it's kind of complicated. But
no, I think it's fascinating. I mean, I'm somebody who, I suffered 2 heart attacks and a stroke.
A what? 2 heart attacks and a stroke?
2 heart attacks and a stroke. Well, don't worry. The stroke was caused by the surgery to relieve the second heart attack because science. But yeah, so I can feel like, trust me, sitting, my first heart attack was on New Year's Eve. I celebrated New Year's Eve 2015 and 2016 in a gown, just finished having heart surgery. All right. I went into the hospital with chest pains on Christmas Day. I walked into there on Christmas Day and then was released because they go, oh, you're 34. You're probably not having a heart attack. It's probably something else. And I lived with a consistent heart attack happening for a week. I was, yeah, trust me. The concept of almost dying and surviving to continue to perform your art, I'm very well versed in it. And I love to hear from other people who have also lived that, like, what's it going to be? I don't know if I'm going to be able to, I don't know if I'm going to live. And if I do live, will I ever be able to do my art ever again? I've lived my entire life off of my voice. Do you understand? If I have a stroke and then I don't like that the rest of my life, my career is over.
Unbelievable.
So I understand that fear of I can't pick up a violin and play it ever again. What will I do with my life? So I literally
can empathize
with that. Yeah, I can totally relate with that fear. And I'd love to hear it from other people. And I understand it's a long story. And some people aren't comfortable talking about those things.
Yeah.
It took me months to start talking. Like, I didn't tell people. The only person that knew I had a heart attack was the roommate who walked me to the emergency room.
No way.
And one other comedian. I told her the day I got out of surgery. Because her and I went and had cheeseburgers together while I was having chest pains.
That was you and Chris Farley.
Yeah, it's an insane story. But it took months for me to start making jokes about it on stage, you know, because it takes time to get through those things. So I understand people aren't comfortable talking about these things, but I am curious, what was it that they were able to do to help cure this, these issues you were having? Was it surgery? Was it physical therapy?
They didn't cure anything. That's why I'm so cynical. I cured it. That's what's so lame about this whole story.
Hey, look, you're also qualified. You got science. You got a master's in science and biology.
Yeah, I have a freaking nursing degree. No, it's that they don't cure this stuff. It's a permanent dosage of Cortef. No,
really?
Yeah, no. But honestly, I don't. I'm not here to advocate certain modalities of medicine. I went elsewhere. I got off the Cortef, but you know, gradually. Let's just say. I'm just shocked at the ignorance, like the willful ignorance in the community because of industry driven stuff. You know, I think it's always going to stay that way for economic reasons, for financial reasons. But yeah, I became a bit cynical about the whole system because of that. Not that there isn't value. You know, I do have family members who were cared for properly and. You know, their symptoms were addressed with their diseases through the medical system. But there's very little that's actually preventative about the systems that are out there. You know, you got to keep coming back for more. that's how the system's built. So anyway, but getting back to your original question, I don't mean to like blow you off or anything, but I don't want to advocate. I think it's irresponsible to advocate a certain modality in medicine and like have people like run. You know, run to do it. Oh, Asher said so. Asher got better. I'm not in the business of. I'm a musician. I sell music. I'm not looking like I left medicine to because I didn't want to sell medicine. I didn't want to sell treatment. And I guess I kind of leave that stuff up. Maybe I'll write a book someday, but I leave that stuff up to the systems that I don't need people hating me. And actually, honestly, a lot of my clients, ironically, are like corporate clients are like. CEOs of like hospitals and long-term care facilities and like they're wonderful people and they're you know they care for anyway I don't want to talk your ear off it's a little complicated for me to get into this stuff.
Look, that's fine. You do not have to advocate for any medical thing. I, as someone who lives with heart disease, which also the fact that I can't eat hot dogs isn't a disease. It's an unfortunate circumstance, but I will advocate eating salads and impossible burgers all day long.
Oh, yeah.
I will be that advocate saying, hey, you want to live a lifetime and eat more salads and less beef. But I'll take the burden there to be the corporate shill for my medical disease.
Let me give like a couple of general ideas just so people aren't like left in the dark as to like the mystery of like how I got better. I'm going to say the tip of the iceberg. Is figuring out what triggers the inflammation. That's what I figured out. And so there were some tests were done. not in-house insurance cover tests, like external tests that gave me information. Like I had to pay a lot of money out of pocket, which is sad and frustrating.
Yeah. It's infuriating that you have to pay for the surgeries of your inflammation out of pocket. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, something, for example, olives, high in monounsaturated fats, super healthy food, right? Deathly allergic. I did not get that because I'm not IgE, immunoglobulin E, reactive to olives. It doesn't show up on the test. That's the only test covered by insurance. I took an immunoassay, whatever, test a number of years ago. I found out that is literally the worst thing I could put on my body. And I tested it out. I was off of it for a month. I cleared out my body. I went back to olives. And I was dead sick the next day. This is something you could say, oh, it's in your brain, Asher, like you're hawking loogies and stuff because it's in your brain. I don't think so. You know, and I tried it a couple times. I stayed off of it for a number of months. Anyway, that's a little tidbit of information that.
Yeah. Well, dude, I'm over here hawking salads and you're over here dying from Greek salads. I get where. Yeah, I eat out of depression. You can't eat Kalamata olives and enjoy them. So I get. Where the uncomfortableness comes in.
Yeah, big mystery. But once I figured it out, it helped. Again, tip of the iceberg, but it helped significantly. That's
great. I'm glad that you're doing better. The last question I'm going to ask you is before we get out of here, you come from a line of both musicians and academics. One of the things I always grew up with, we had this PSA in the Baltimore area that, and there was charity organizations to help support putting music education in schools, because the things they always backed behind was music education helps you academically. Is that something that you growing up also feel is a truth, or is that one of those things that they just said that never really, like, learning to read music helps you read better? Is that something accurate, you think, in your life?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say they've done a number of what is it called? Like neurological studies, like MRIs, where they've scanned the brain, brains of musicians while they were performing, while they were thinking about music, and the whole brain lights up, and there are like these cross-sectional interactions and connections between the right and left lobe, and so on and so forth. It's pretty incredible what happens to the brain when music is being played. You're processing many different things at once, and I think that's helped me. That's built many, many strengths and helped me throughout life in many regards. So, I'd have to agree with that in a nutshell.
That's good. And this is the last thing I ask you, because I know you got a heart out and get out of here. We talked about your kids a little bit. What instruments are your kids playing, and how do you stave off trying to be like, slapping their fingers when they're playing scales and correcting, like, you need to be better at this?
So my son, he's got a talent, the piano. We started him off on the piano. He didn't have such a he had too much of a traditional teacher, so I think we need to kind of work on. It's been a year or two; we've taken him off of that, but I think he has a lot of potential. My daughter, she loves the piano too. She's like over here. I got this side of the studio. She's playing the piano, and then they're like fighting over like sharing it. So I got to get a third piano because I'm using my MIDI for production. Anyway, piano is what we got.
You can't convince him to play chopsticks together.
They can't get along when it comes to like sharing. I mean, they love each other. I don't know what it is. I got to work on that part. It's a work in progress.
Awesome. Asher, it was great having you in despite all our technical difficulties on both ends.
Adds to the fun.
But no, it was great having you. It was wonderful to hear your story. I'm glad that you're doing better, health wise. I'm glad that you were able to figure out what works for you. For me, someone who lives, like I said, with mental illness, with an eating disorder, with depression, it's a constant ongoing battle for me. Like, and I can empathize with the food thing, because if you're an alcoholic, you can just, I'm not saying it's easy, but you can give up alcohol. You can just not drink, right? If that's your vice. My vice is eating. I can't just not eat. I have to learn to eat right and I have to stick to it. And when you're an emotional eater, the other day it happened. I got mad about something, and the first thing I did was open a pack of Swiss rolls, right? So those are the things that I have to learn to get through. And it's nice to hear success stories of other people who are living with health disorders and that they're able to get over those health disorders and get back to the things they're doing and live their life. So it's an inspiring story, and I'm really glad that you're open and you shared it with us here. And I'm glad that we made the time, despite all the other things going on in our lives, we made the time to have this conversation.
Yeah, well, I just want to intervene for a second since you mentioned that, if people are interested. I think it's fascinating that consumption, eating food, is part of the addiction part of the brain, like carbohydrate intake, that kind of stuff. And that's what's incredible. Like, people don't really see it that way. But it is, because it's really a prerequisite to surviving. If it isn't part of addiction, we would forget to eat. And that's pretty much numero uno, the most important things to, again, to living our lives. So, you know, it's easier said than done. And people shouldn't beat themselves up over, like, the difficulty of, you know, eating right, eating wrong. Like, our country is a mess when it comes to, like, the food industry. And it's, we're the recipients of that mess, and it needs to be changed. That's a political conversation.
I mean, I'm trying to get myself off high fructose corn syrup drinks, and I can't, just because they're so ubiquitous. I don't even like them. I just, oh, it's there.
It's not your fault. It's not your fault, because it's everywhere. Yeah, it's ubiquitous. It's the fault of the food industry and the politicians that are allowing it to be as prevalent as it is. And, you know, people love the taste. A lot of people love the taste. I'm not talking about yourself, but like the rest of the world.
Oh, I hate it.
But they allow it because they're like, they're accustomed to the taste. It's a vicious cycle. And I'd love, I don't know, if I had the time or the money to go into politics, I would. And I'd say, like, guys, let's stop it. Like, we're making ourselves sick. And I don't know. Yeah, it's a whole other conversation.
I mean, the drinks with sugar taste better. I like the ones that's made with sugar. They taste better. I like them better. But the high fructose corn syrup ones are there. They make my mouth drier. They don't taste as good.
Yeah.
But I work in a building that has a cafeteria and there's free soda there. And it's really hard to just move my hand 6 inches to the left and hit water.
Yeah.
Because it keeps going to Mountain Dew.
Well, and it's like synthetic flavors are much cheaper to produce on part of the company. So why would they, like, if it's legal, why would they not produce it? Like, why would they not want to make millions of dollars more per year if they're permitted to do so? And that is the problem.
Yeah. And we could go on for hours about that. Yeah. In fact, I think Netflix made a documentary about it.
Well, there should be many documentaries. Somewhere to
go. I got some editing to start. I got to edit out all our technical difficulties from these recordings. It was lovely having you, talking to you. And when you come to play with the Boston Philharmonic or the Boston Symphony, whatever they call
Boston
themselves
Pops,
here,
yeah.
Reach out and I'll be there in my nice little rented tux, and I'll be watching.
You can show up in that shirt. I'd love it.